From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the Capitol shuts down as Michigan's electors prepare to cast their ballots.
But as far as the procedure goes, this should be the same as always, but a lot more people are paying attention to it.
Also, how Michigan's governor hopes to reawaken the spirit of an old legal concept to revoke permits on Enbridge's Line 5.
Resources like the Great Lakes are held in a public trust, meaning they can be used for public good and benefit and not solely for private gain.
Plus, the first round of coronavirus vaccines rolls off the line in Kalamazoo, met with joy and skepticism.
This vaccine is like hope in a vial that's being administered to healthcare workers and then eventually to all of us, if we're willing to take it.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, many Americans are breathing a sigh of relief. The FDA has cleared Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. Next comes the monumental task of getting those vaccines to the people who need them most.
I'm quite proud and also hopeful today, given that I know that vaccine distribution means the end of this pandemic will be here.
Later on the show, we'll talk with the state's chief medical executive, Jonay Khaldun, about what that's going to look like. But first, in Lansing, Michigan's electors are bringing a long-anticipated end to Election 2020. They met in person at the Capitol today to cast ballots for the Electoral College, recognizing Joe Biden's win in Michigan. But it really wouldn't be 2020 if this typically uneventful procedure went off as usual. WKAR reporter Abigail Sensky is covering the proceedings from Lansing and joins us now. Hi, Abby.
Hey, April. Thanks for having me.
So the Senate's Capitol building was closed today to the public. Typically, the Senate gallery would be full of observers. What can you tell us about why things are shut down?
That's right. Well, after receiving what a spokeswoman for the Senate, Republican leaders in the Senate, called credible threats of violence, the Capitol Commission elected earlier last week to close the building to the public. And that's been the same with DHHS orders that we've seen throughout the whole pandemic. The Capitol is usually closed on non-session days. But like we said, the Michigan State Police passed along threats to Republican leaders who then decided to close House and Senate office buildings. And there were expected protests. We even saw a state representative, Republican Gary Eisen, say that he wasn't sure if today would be free from violence. So there, things are being done really carefully here, and there's a big state police presence inside of the Capitol.
Does it mean anything different for the logistics of the electoral process?
So yes and no. It's far fewer people inside of the building, and things are, of course, being done differently for COVID. Everyone here has masks and had to undergo temperature checks to get in the building. But as far as the procedure goes, this should be the same as always, but a lot more people are paying attention to it. The same kind of situation that we saw with the Board of State canvassers, because so many doubts have been raised without proof about the integrity of this election.
Abby, I know you spoke with the governor this afternoon. What did she have to say?
Well, she called, you know, any doubts that are being cast on this and any threats of violence unpatriotic, and said that those shouldn't be happening. And she said she was no stranger to that, as the target of an alleged plot to kidnap her earlier this year. But she said she's optimistic about the healing of our nation and President-elect Joe Biden's ability to do that as a candidate, and she has faith in the longevity of the process and our system.
Do you have any sense of how the electors themselves are feeling about being the center of national attention for this process that normally goes off without much notice at all?
Right. I mean, at least one elector has told me, you know, she didn't expect this, and she certainly was watchful of any threats and the moments leading up to this day. But she said as soon as the electors knew, which was Friday, that they would receive police escorts, she felt better about it. And many of these electors feel this is an integral part of the process, and they're just reconfirming what the country has already confirmed, that the country wants to elect President-elect Joe Biden.
Hey, Abby, this is a year in which the grass in Lansing has gotten a proper trouncing. I can't, you know, so many protests over so many things, from COVID to elections. Are there many protesters out today?
I didn't see many when I came in the building. Everyone who is inside of the building came in through a specific entrance, but all reporting that we're seeing says there's a light protest presence, and there's a much bigger presence thus far of journalists and police.
Do you have any information about what the protesters are there for, or were they more generally protesting the electoral process?
I believe protesting the electoral process more than anything.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that a Republican state legislator, Gary Eisen, did a radio interview this morning and said that there are still plans in place to try to send a slate of Trump-supporting electors. He's also one of the state lawmakers who chose to sign on to the Texas lawsuit against Michigan. And he said that he couldn't promise there would not be violence today at the Capitol. Was there any reaction to that from the legislators' leaders?
Yeah, absolutely. House Speaker Lee Chatfield, who's outgoing, and Republican Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey stripped Representative Eisen of his committees for making those kind of imposing and threatening statements. And that's following when Rep. Johnson was stripped of her committee assignments for making what they called threatening comments last week. So he's been stripped of his committee assignments for the duration of the legislative term, and we'll see what more comes out against it today. They also strongly condemned his words.
I believe I saw a tweet today in which the Senate's majority leader, Republican Mike Shirkey, went so far as to call Joe Biden the president-elect. I think that's stronger language than he has used to this point. Why did it take so long for the Republican leadership to admit that that was the result of the vote in Michigan?
Well, you know, that's really an open question. I think that we've seen the Republican leaders are feeling a lot of pressure from their base to investigate, you know, what the Republicans have been calling all along irregularities without any proof. And they've continued to do that. But, you know, these Republican leaders also believe in the sanctity of our process and our system of government. And they made statements to that effect today, saying, you know, while they were disappointed with the outcome of this election, Lee Chatfield went as far to say that he fears we would lose our country if we were to not allow the electoral process to proceed as it is supposed to by state law and, of course, the U.S. Constitution. So I think any pressure they've faced thus far in not making hard statements comes from their base, which is inextricable with Trump supporters at this point.
Yeah. Just to tease this out a little bit, Lee Chatfield is done with his term in the House, and Mike Shirkey is term limited out of the Michigan Senate in just a couple of years. Do you have any sense of whether their stance might be any different if they were up for re-election?
You know, that's hard to say, especially considering we saw four members of our Republican congressional delegation also question things and sign on to this Texas lawsuit before the Supreme Court threw it out. So that's an open question as to, you know, if they would have changed their behavior if they had a longer term in the Michigan State Legislature in front of them. What I can say is there is a small caucus of Republicans who have been driving kind of these investigations, but right now they're not powerful enough to overpower the leaders or the majority of their caucus.
Abby, do you know if the Michigan GOP has had anything to say about today's proceedings?
They've continued to cast doubt on the process, but we'll see if they actually are more involved or have statements after this. You know, we at least heard the Trump administration signaling this morning that they don't view things as over until January 6th, when Congress officially counts these electoral college votes. So they're kind of moving the goalposts as they have been throughout the process. And, you know, I don't think it's out of the question to expect a similar statement from the Michigan Republican Party after today's vote.
Right. Have we heard anything concrete about whether the Trump campaigns to file any more lawsuits in Michigan?
Not that I'm aware of. And they did just have a suit thrown out of Wisconsin court. So, you know, given their track record of lawsuits in Michigan, I don't think there's really a huge amount of legal strategy that there's left to pursue here.
Yeah. Can you give us any sense of just what the mood is in the room today? There was so much anticipation and so much legal wrangling leading up to this day. And obviously that extra element that the perceived security threats have added to the proceedings. I mean, what's it like there compared with a normal session day?
You know, it is way more cautious, I would say, first and foremost. Everyone is extremely vigilant. Everyone is watching over things. And I think the other moods of particularly the electors here are, you know, a mix of determined and solemn as well.
Abby Sensky covers the Capitol for Station WKAR. Abby, thanks very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Electors are meeting all over the United States today. Vermont's process was the first in the nation to go forward this morning. And it turned out that Michigan was not the only place where heightened security measures came into play. The Associated Press reports that Georgia's state police were deployed at that state's Capitol building. The slate of electors includes some of the state's top political names, including activist and former candidate for governor Stacey Abrams. But no protesters showed up at the Georgia Capitol as of our broadcast time today. Electors have codified their results in Pennsylvania and Georgia as well. Joe Biden is expected to formally receive more than 270 electoral college votes after California meets this afternoon. But the Trump campaign and administration does not appear poised to accept today's results. Here's Trump advisor Stephen Miller on Fox and Friends this morning.
The only date in the Constitution is January 20th. So we have more than enough time to right the wrong of this fraudulent election result and certify Donald Trump as the winner of the election. As we speak today, an alternate slate of electors in the contested states is going to vote, and we're going to send those results up to Congress. This will ensure that all of our legal remedies remain open. That means that if we win these cases in the courts, that we can direct that the alternate slate of electors be certified. The state legislatures in Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania can do the same. And likewise, Congress has that opportunity as well to do the right thing. If you just cured three simple constitutional defects, Donald Trump's the winner of this election.
All the same, Joe Biden is the president-elect after today, officially. No more mincing words. Up next, the legal battles over the controversial Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac continue. This is a line that sends petroleum products from Canada to Canada with a detour through the United States. We'll speak with an environmental advocate about the latest in just a moment. Don't go away. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Exactly 2 years ago at this time, we got some big news out of Lansing. In the final days of Governor Rick Snyder's administration, a lame duck session of the Michigan legislature pushed through a plan to build a tunnel between the upper and lower peninsulas. The purpose? To house an Enbridge pipeline that came to be known as Line 5. The pipeline currently lies on the lake floor underneath the Straits of Mackinac, carrying petroleum products from Manitoba across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan to their final destination in Sarnia, Ontario. Since that point, the legal battles have been nonstop. Joining us to provide some more details is the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Executive Director, Mike Schreiberg. Mike, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
What was different in 1953 when the state first agreed to allow Enbridge to operate this line?
You know, maybe the biggest thing is our basic environmental laws weren't in place. No Clean Water Act, no Clean Air Act, no Great Lakes Submerged Lands Act. So the basic regulatory system wasn't there. And in fact, both the past Attorney General Bill Schuette and the current Attorney General Dana Nessel have said Line 5 would have never been permitted today, but 1953 just did not have those same environmental values in our legal system.
This month, the state of Michigan moved to revoke that original Line 5 permit. And in doing so, the state argued last month that the public trust had not been fully considered when the easement was granted, which I think was the legalese way of saying what you just said. Is that argument new in terms of the legal history of Line 5?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's new, but it's the first time that a governor has actually asserted it in that way. So what Governor Whitmer did just a month ago was something that was quite new, because she actually revoked the easement that was granted in 1953, and she started a 180-day window by the end of that time. So that would go till May 12th of next year. Line 5 is required to be removed from the Straits of Mackinac if everything stays the same. So that is actually a major, major twist and turn in the story. And it's probably the most important thing that's happened in the 10-year battle over Line 5.
Could you unpack the concept of public trust, which has become important as the state is now asserting that that should be the primary consideration in all decisions around Line 5's future?
Yeah, its most basic level, it says that resources like the Great Lakes are held in a public trust, meaning that they can be used for public good and benefit and not solely for private gain. And, you know, that also means that an operator who is in the Great Lakes has to actually adhere to what's beneficial for the state. It's been a principle that's long been in law and long debated, but there's very solid ground to say that Line 5 right now is in violation of the public trust, because there's very little actual public benefit and there's a huge potential public cost if there is a spill. And that's essentially the argument that the governor and the attorney general are using, part of the argument that they're using to remove Line 5.
At the same time, it's not as if the public's best interests have not been in play in the years of lawsuits and challenges that have been going on. And I think Enbridge would make the case that they've invested a lot of money in at least trying to make the old line work as long as possible. Is it disingenuous to make the argument that the public trust hasn't been in play all these years?
I think the first thing you have to realize is that Michigan and the Great Lakes are a shortcut. About 90% of the input in Line 5, and it's oil and natural gas liquids, goes through Michigan and the Great Lakes and is not utilized here. So when you think about what the value of Line 5 is, it's that small portion of the line that's actually used in the U.S. for a few things. Fortunately, there are good substitutes for that.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt. Why didn't Enbridge just build its line through Canada?
Well, you know, if they went up through the northern parts of Lake Superior around that shoreline, the simple reason is it would be a lot more expensive and it's a lot further. The shape of Lake Superior sticks far out to the north, and it's even more remote. I mean, it makes the UP look like it's heavily populated compared to the northern shores of Lake Superior. So it simply would have been more expensive and harder to do at the time.
We should say something about how the public trust is baked into Michigan's laws. Public trust responsibilities are actually embedded in Michigan's state constitution. If a court were to sanction the state's arguments and say, yes, you know, Attorney General Nessel, you're correct in this interpretation, has the Whitmer administration just invoked something that can't be worked around short of a statewide vote, some kind of ballot initiative campaign?
Yeah, I mean, public trust is well established in the law. I think this usage would hold up very well in the courts and would give the state leverage to actually try and act in the best interest. And I think that's what the governor and the attorney general are doing. And I should say, Enbridge has filed a counter lawsuit, which says essentially the state has no authority in the Great Lakes. It's only a federal issue. And therefore, the governor and the attorney general have no right to protect the Great Lakes. That would be unprecedented, and that would be damaging not just to Line 5 if they were to win. I think it's a long shot, but if they were, not just to Line 5, but to the protection of natural resources that are held in public trust throughout the state and throughout the country. So it's very closely watched because of the counter argument that Enbridge has made, which is essentially the state has no right to protect its own water.
How do you think about the legal architecture of Michigan's public trust requirements compared with the separate structure of federal oversight for pipelines? I mean, have courts traditionally lent more weight to, you know, federal responsibilities versus state responsibilities in these kinds of cases?
Yeah, well, so in general, pipeline safety is a federal responsibility because it's an interstate commerce. So if you think about it, Line 5 starts in Wisconsin and ends in Ontario. That's clearly interstate and international commerce. Now, the unique thing here is the crossing at the Straits of Mackinac goes from obviously one part of Michigan to another. And the water there is clearly held in trust by the state of Michigan. That's why this case does not revolve around the entirety of Line 5. It's that segment that goes underwater, or it's on the bottom of the water right now, in the Straits of Mackinac. And that's where the state has clear authority, even though the overall oversight for pipelines is in the federal authority. That's why it can be confusing in the public mind. But the state's authority is clear there, although Enbridge is challenging it in federal court right now. That's what the legal debate is about.
So there's a whole separate track to this story in that Enbridge is going through a lengthy permitting process to try to build the pipeline that would ultimately replace Line 5 along a similar geographic route. Do we know for sure whether the state will try or would be able to block that permit?
We do not. And what Enbridge is proposing is building a tunnel basically underneath, directly underneath one of the segments of Line 5. It splits into two in the Straits. And underneath one of it, they're trying to put a new tunnel. The problem there is that that would take 5 to 10 years to do. It would cost, Enbridge says, $500 million. Independent experts say more like $1 billion. And there's some concern about whether they're actually serious about doing this. But that is a separate track. Right now, the debate is what happens with the current segment that's sitting in the open waters of the Great Lakes. That's what the governor's decision last month was about, and that's what's playing out in the courts. There is a separate round of permitting on the tunnel. In theory, a tunnel could still be permitted even if the current segment is shut down. Enbridge has every right to continue pursuing that. And it's pretty early in the regulatory and legal process for the permitting for the tunnel.
I wonder if pipeline opponents are counting on a probability that if the original easement is invalidated and the old pipeline has to be shut down, that would undermine arguments for building a new one, saying, hey, you know, you don't have any, you know, you don't have your product running through this route anyway right now. So why should the state of Michigan let you build a new line here?
Yeah, you know, I can't obviously speak for Enbridge, but if I were Enbridge, I'd be very worried if that was a scenario, because I think what will happen is if we presume the current line gets shut down in May, there are going to be alternatives that come into play. So then it's a very hard case for Enbridge to make that they need to restart this and put it into a tunnel, because it'll show that Line 5 is not critical energy infrastructure. And that's why Enbridge is fighting so hard right now to stop the governor and the attorney general from essentially protecting the Great Lakes and particularly our recreational tourism economy. I think that's why Enbridge is fighting so hard.
Mike, why wouldn't it be in Michigan's interest to have a newer pipeline along this route, built along more modern specs?
Yeah, if that was actually what was being proposed, Enbridge has not proposed replacing any segment of its aging pipeline besides the part in the bottom of the Straits. If Enbridge could wave a magic wand and say, we're going to put a brand new pipeline in place, including a tunnel tomorrow, you know, that might be a debate worth having. That gets into issues of, do we really want Michigan committed to another 100 years of a fossil fuel economy? There are other reasons why that might not be true. But the reality is they're proposing at best patchwork along the existing segments of Line 5. They've actually been fined for safety violations just recently on the land-based segments. And they're proposing at some distant point in the future, a replacement of the water-based segment in a tunnel, which is not proven technology. And Enbridge has done a very poor job of making the case that it's necessary. So it's not really a choice of, do we want something brand new right now, or do we want old infrastructure? It's really a choice of, what do we do to protect the Great Lakes at this moment from what is an imminent risk?
Mike Schreiberg is Executive Director for the Great Lakes Region for the National Wildlife Federation. Mike, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
In a request for comment, Enbridge sent us this statement from Vern Yu, Executive Vice President of Enbridge, and it reads in part, quoting here, "In the face of continued roadblocks by this administration, it's time for the state to stop playing politics with the energy needs and anxieties of U.S. and Canadian consumers and businesses that depend on Line 5. It is concerning to see the current administration is willing to compromise those needs. We remain highly committed to protecting the Great Lakes, the environment, and all the people who use these waters while delivering energy that people rely on daily." federal prosecutors and union leaders announced this afternoon they've reached a civil settlement aimed at reforming the union. This comes after a multi-year investigation into fraud and corruption at the UAW, which has already led to more than a dozen criminal convictions for union leaders and auto industry execs. Here to talk to us about what reform might look like is Daniel House, business editor for the Detroit News and columnist. Daniel, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this was just announced at 1 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
At first blush, what do you see as the major takeaways?
Well, the major takeaway, obviously, is you are going to have some measure of federal monitoring. They're not using the word oversight per se, but technically that's really what it is. The UAW is going to put forth three names as essentially nominees, and they will then talk with the feds about who they feel comfortable with. And at that point, then it would take it to a court and they would approve that monitor. And that would last for, I believe they said 6 years, but it could be extended. It could also be shortened, I think, in theory. The big news really is that they're going to have a vote on how to vote. Within the union, they're going to ask the membership, do they want to, in fact, move to direct elections of officers away from a delegate elections, which they've essentially done since the beginning of the union. And it's really been controlled by what is known as the Reuther Administrative Caucus, named after Walter Reuther, the legendary UAW president who died in a plane crash in 1970.
Sure.
So I think that's really going to be the big issue as we go forward here. President Rory Gamble made it clear that they're not going to just let this happen, in the sense that they are going to tell their members what they believe is the reality of moving to direct elections. And in reporting for these stories and columns over the last couple of years, I've had several conversations with union people who talk about all the bad things that they believe could happen. It could be a lot more costly, for example, to run for, say, a president for a national office and be very prohibitive in terms of running and campaigning and this, that, and the other thing. But they're going to address that, I think, as they go forward.
Daniel, I'm fascinated that the federal government didn't say, you're going to change your elections. The federal government said, you're going to have a vote of the membership to see if they want to change how you do elections. What's going on here?
Well, what I think is very interesting is Matthew Schneider, and this is happening in a very important political context. I mean, we're talking about the waning weeks of the Trump administration. So they're going to have a new U.S. attorney by all rights, probably sometime in the first quarter, not only in Detroit, but in a lot of places around the country. So they're kind of running out of time here to put this whole thing together. So that's point one. Point two is I think that they are trying to respect the membership, the government is, meaning, you know, he made a point of saying there are not fines. We're not fining the UAW, because if we fine the UAW, that is paid by essentially the members. They really are trying to be deferential to letting the members decide. That's the way the union is supposed to operate. And I think when it comes to something as important as the election of their officers, they want them to decide, because it would require a change in their constitution. And the UAW takes its constitution seriously. And you just don't unilaterally change the constitution. You don't do it as the president of the union, and you don't do it as a U.S. attorney. And so I think they're trying to be respectful of that and say, ultimately, this is not about breaking the union. This is about taking corruption out of the union and letting the union do what it was founded to do, which is to represent its members, the working men and women working in auto plants and all sorts of other, you know, in academia and casinos and whatever else they've got. They've got a lot of different industries that they operate in. That's really what this is about.
And it should be said, this is in the context of a corruption scandal in which top union officials were spending dues on lavish lifestyles, accepting gifts from negotiators at Fiat Chrysler. I mean, I assume that there has been a serious degradation of union members' faith in the organization. Do you think this is good for the union as well?
Well, we shall see. I think there's always skepticism. And I've pointed out many times in columns over the years that this corruption scandal essentially affirms the worst assumptions that they have on the factory floor, which is that the leadership isn't in it for us. They're in it for themselves. And so we then saw evidence of that, and more evidence, and yet more evidence. And we have two presidents who have pled guilty. One, and I think one of them's been charged, or sentenced rather, or maybe that got moved. But in any case, they've been charged, and two vice presidents, it's a total of 15 people, 12 of whom are affiliated with the union, 3 of whom are affiliated with Fiat Chrysler.
Gosh. Dan, how do you think these reforms might impact the auto industry more broadly, if at all?
Well, I think it puts the UAW on notice that people are going to be watching them and watching how they behave. And so I think the companies probably see this as a benefit in the grand scheme of things. And I think that they used this opportunity when they were going through negotiations, contract negotiations, to essentially exit out of these national training centers. I believe that the one that the GM has with the UAW that sits on the Detroit River was just sold to a developer. They want to get out because they see this as it's this corporate money that funds these training centers, by the way. So, and initially we thought in this scandal that it was just the corporate money that was being misspent. Well, we now know that it was dues money also that was being misspent by officers. So, you know, I think the union or the companies probably see this as a benefit.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor with the Detroit News. Thank you so much for the insight.
You bet.
Coming up, Pfizer employees and nearby residents watched over the weekend as the first trucks containing the recently approved coronavirus vaccine hit the road.
And they were just in tears. They were so moved by seeing how their community had played such a big role in making this vaccine happen.
The vaccine rollout in Michigan, that's next after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. On Saturday, a convoy of trucks rolled out of the Pfizer manufacturing facility in Portage, carrying the first doses of the company's freshly FDA-approved COVID vaccine. Hopes are beyond high that this might be the beginning of the end for the pandemic that has brought so much to a standstill here in Michigan this year and across the country. Kristen Jordan-Shamus covers healthcare for the Detroit Free Press, and she was there when it happened. Kristen, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, thanks so much for talking to me today.
What was it like watching those trucks roll out?
It was pretty amazing. You know, we got there in the dark. It was the pre-dawn hours. So we arrived about 4 o'clock in the morning and watched as the first FedEx truck pulled up. And then that was followed by a UPS truck and one from a company called Boyle Transportation, which does a lot of like healthcare transport and that sort of thing. And it was neat to see them arrive. But what was really powerful, I thought, was when the people who live in that area, in the Kalamazoo area, in Portage, in Plainwell, when they all started to pull up in their cars and they parked on the sides of the road and they got out and they were just in tears. They were so moved by seeing how their community had played such a big role in making this vaccine happen. Wow. They knew people who worked for Pfizer, who worked for the company that Pfizer was before it changed its name to Pfizer. It was used to be the Upjohn company. Mm-hmm. They had relatives and friends who all worked really hard, either in the past or currently for that company. And they felt like it was almost as if, you know, they had a role in it in the same way that the workers did. It was pretty neat to see them so moved by what was going on.
Kristen, were these folks who had their own lives changed this year?
Absolutely. I spoke to one woman. She was so sweet. She's 76 years old, and she was talking about how before the pandemic, she used to care for her great-grandchildren and how her great-granddaughter, Lizzie, she hasn't been able to see her because of COVID-19, and it's been very, very hard for her. She was very sad by the fact that she's been separated from her family for so long. And watching those trucks pull out, she got teary. She cried a little bit. And she said, I really just want to be able to see my Lizzie again.
Could you describe the scale of what was going on in Portage and Kalamazoo that day? I mean, just we know that, like you said, you know, the entire Pfizer operation has been nonstop on this. But what about the logistical effort?
Sure. It was a pretty massive effort. So, you know, over the spring and summer, when Pfizer committed to start making this vaccine, they really had to make a commitment to create a vaccine and upscale manufacturing, even though they didn't know if their vaccine would get approved by the FDA and the CDC and would ever make it to market. So it was a pretty big investment that the company had to make in this vaccine. And it was like an investment in hope, really, and an investment in being part of the solution. And this is what a lot of these pharmaceutical companies are doing right now. They just went all in, even though there may not be a return for them on it. And so Pfizer hired 400 extra workers for that Kalamazoo facility to try to work specifically on the COVID vaccine. It invested, I think it was $1.5 million is what the one of the company officials told me earlier this year. They had to buy freezers and bring in scores and scores of freezers to keep these vaccines that they were making at ultra cold temperatures of minus 94 degrees, which is how these vaccines have to be stored. I mean, and they worked around the clock. Absolutely, they did. They even had to come up with a solution for how to ship those ultra cold vaccines. So you can't just put them on in a box and throw them on a FedEx truck. They have to be in these thermal packages that are filled with dry ice that will keep them at that super cold temperature, you know, to make it out to the hospitals and the health departments and all the other places where these vaccines will be administered across the country.
Kristen, I know you've talked to people who work at hospitals and nursing homes and a lot of people whose family members have been suffering from COVID, but have you had a chance to talk to that many people who've been involved at Pfizer and just to hear like what the vibe is like when they as they've been working on this?
I wish I could say I have, but I've not. You know, the company has really kept it under wraps. I've asked several times for those interviews or to even come out to the facility in Portage and take a look at what's going on there. But they've really kept it quiet and they have not been inviting media out or press out. And part of that is because of COVID-19. So they're making this vaccine, which they want to use and administer in people all around the country and around the world, and they don't want their workers to get sick. And bringing in the press or anybody to their facility at a time when they're trying to do this critical work is a risk that they didn't want to take.
Sure. What do we know about who's getting doses so far?
We know that some of the first healthcare workers were in New York City to get vaccinated. And so there was a critical care nurse in New York City who got one of the first vaccines today. And that happened this morning. We know that here in Michigan, we're going to start seeing healthcare workers vaccinated here this afternoon. I believe that there will be some folks up near Flint who are getting vaccines with McLaren Healthcare. Tied with Walgreens. Walgreens pharmacists are going to help administer vaccines for McLaren. We also know that Michigan Medicine in Ann Arbor also will be giving out some vaccines to healthcare workers this afternoon.
This news, it just feels really timely right now.
I think this is just a really hopeful time. I think it's a time when we look at the numbers of COVID-19 across the country and we're looking at death rates that are soaring nationally. We're looking at infection rates that are going through the roof. We're looking ahead at next week with Christmas and this week with Hanukkah. And we're thinking about all the family members and the loved ones that we miss right now. This vaccine is like hope in a vial that's being administered to healthcare workers and then eventually to all of us if we're willing to take it. And I think a lot of us really need to consider whether the risk from the virus is greater or less than their perceived risk of the vaccine, which has been found to be safe and effective, which has gotten authorization and has been reviewed by the top scientists around the country. And so I think those are things that we have to think about as individuals and as a country and what our decisions, what kind of impact our decisions will have on the nation.
Kristen Jordan Seamus covers healthcare, among other topics, for the Detroit Free Press. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, and take care.
Some of the decisions about who gets vaccinated first are easy. But after Michigan's hospital staff and nursing home residents are taken care of, there are lots of other considerations and other decisions to be made beyond who's getting vaccinated. Dr. Jonay Khaldun is health director for the state of Michigan. Dr. Khaldun, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
We've heard that people who were watching the trucks carrying the vaccine doses out of the Pfizer manufacturing plant were pretty emotional on Saturday morning when they took in that sight. I was wondering how you're feeling today.
You know, I am quite proud and hopeful today, seeing the pictures of those trucks rolling out of the Pfizer plant, knowing that they were manufactured, the vaccines were manufactured right here in my home state of Michigan was simply amazing. And I also got an opportunity to see the vaccines being delivered at the University of Michigan this morning. So I'm quite proud and also hopeful today, given that I know that vaccine distribution means the end of this pandemic will be here.
Can you remind us what the plan is at this point for who's in line for vaccination?
Yes. Yeah, so the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, we are following CDC and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a national body of experts that advises the CDC. We are following their recommendations and ethical principles when it comes to allocating. The first people to be vaccinated will be those who are working on the front lines in our hospitals. So medical floors, emergency departments, intensive care units, and also emergency medical services, those providers. We will then, again, as vaccine becomes more available, we will extend out to residents and staff of long-term care facilities. We will extend to other frontline healthcare workers in outpatient settings, laboratories, pharmacies. And then, again, timing will depend on how much vaccine we get and when, but we will extend out into essential workers, individuals who are at high risk of having severe COVID illness, having medical conditions such as diabetes or high blood pressure. And then we will eventually be able to make this vaccine available to the general public, hopefully by late spring.
What should Michiganders expect when they receive the vaccine?
So that's a great question. Everyone, every adult, every person age 16 and up should be planning right now for when they will get the vaccine. You should expect that you will have to get two doses. So for the Pfizer vaccine, the one that we are rolling out starting today, you can expect a second shot 3 weeks after the first. What you can also expect is that many people may get some very mild side effects of the vaccine. What that means is that your immune system is working. Things like a sore arm or a low-grade fever or just feeling generally fatigued, those are all signs that the vaccine is working. And you may have some of those symptoms for a couple of days after you get the vaccine.
Is there anything that you'd like to say to people who have reservations about taking the vaccine, who feel like they may not trust it at this point?
You know, everyone has a right to have questions and to have their questions answered. I would say it's important that people go to credible sources for information. We do have a website, michigan.gov/COVID vaccine, where people can go for more information. What I can tell you, April, the scientific process has not been skipped in any way for this vaccine. The technology for this vaccine has been studied for many, many years, and that is why our scientists, our researchers were able to get this vaccine out and authorized so quickly. It's because the research has already been done for years on this specific type of vaccine.
You mean coronaviruses, right?
On this specific type of vaccine, this is a messenger RNA vaccine, and so this is a vaccine that actually works with the protein that is on the virus that essentially helps your cells recognize the virus, to keep it very simple. And so this type of messenger RNA vaccine, this is a technology that has been studied in other areas for some time. And that is why we've been able to advance it for COVID vaccines as quickly as possible.
Right. Dr. Khaldun, if we can turn to the bigger picture, what can you tell us about the number of COVID infections and hospitalizations and how they're looking in Michigan right now?
Yeah, you know, they are still alarmingly high. I've seen some promising data, and we will be updating the state a little more in the upcoming days. But we've seen some promising data about our cases and hospitalizations coming down. But again, we need to do a more thorough review of the data. Of course, we watch trends when it comes to things like our rates of cases and the tests that are being done, how many of those are coming back positive. But we are hopeful that we will start seeing numbers coming down.
I've seen some reporting suggesting that perhaps, just perhaps, Michigan did not experience a surge of cases because of people gathering over Thanksgiving. Do you think that that may be true?
You know, that is certainly my hope and what we were asking, pleading of everyone to do over the Thanksgiving holiday. Again, we will be sharing more information about that specific data in the upcoming days.
Right. What would you like to know for people who may be thinking about the holidays going on now in December and the very strong magnetic pull of getting together with people we love?
I know it's going to be incredibly hard. It has been a very challenging year for everyone. And so, again, I'm recommending that everyone continue to do your part. We all have a role to play, regardless of your political affiliation, in ending this pandemic. And the end of this pandemic is near. With vaccine rollout, that is exactly what that means. If everyone can do their part, not gather in groups over the holidays, we will be at the end of this pandemic in 2021. We can save lives. It's just so important that people continue to do things like wearing masks, washing hands, and not gathering in large groups.
One last question. We spoke not too long ago with a pediatrician in Southeast Michigan who was part of a group of more than 100 MDs asking his local public school district to send younger kids back to the classroom, pointing out that he and his colleagues have seen children experiencing a range of health issues, including their emotional and mental stability, being really challenged at this time. The district told us that would be impossible because of staffing issues, just too many people either sick or in quarantine because of exposure. Do you think it's realistic for Michigan to hope that younger students will be able to go back to school in springtime?
You know, I am certainly optimistic that we will be able to get our children back into in-person school as quickly as possible. That is why, actually, under the current state epidemic order, kindergarten through eighth grade is actually permitted to be in person per our state order right now. That is why we are elevating the role of K through 12 school teachers, and as far as being able to get a vaccination under our essential workers phase. And so, again, we are incredibly hopeful. And I certainly, as the mother of three children who are homes at home in school, two of them, it is incredibly important that we get our kids back in school. So I certainly understand the challenges there.
Dr. Khaldun, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Stay well.
Dr. Jonay Khaldun is Chief Medical Officer for the state of Michigan. Michiganders stood outside and cheered as those first shipments of COVID vaccine left the Pfizer facility and headed for their intended destinations.
A monumental moment takes place in Portage as the first batch of the COVID-19 vaccination takes off nationwide.
I guess what's exciting is that it puts us on the map. That's exciting in and of itself.
Today, those vaccines began to find their way into the arms of healthcare workers who are on the front lines of fighting the virus.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you feeling today?
I am feeling great.
Sandra Lindsay, an ICU nurse in New York, was the first American to publicly receive the vaccine. Lindsay said it felt like getting any other vaccination shot.
Everything worked perfectly. Thank you.
And you're feeling well?
I'm Governor Cuomo. I'm feeling well. I would like to thank all the frontline workers, all my colleagues who've been doing a yeoman's job to fight this pandemic all over the world. I am hopeful. I feel hopeful today. I'm relieved. I feel like healing is coming. I hope this marks the beginning to the end of a very painful time in our history.
Here's to many more stories of simultaneously momentous and uneventful administration of millions of inoculations in the coming months. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, by April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.